Well, over the past few weeks, we have been doing a series entitled Finishing Well, and we've been looking primarily through the book of 1 Samuel at the life of the prophet Samuel, who was one of Israel's judges. We've looked at his mother, Hannah, and her great influence on his life and her example. We've looked at the life of Eli, the high priest, and his sons, Hophni and Phinehas, and their fall from grace, how they created such great turmoil in the nation. And we're quickly coming up on the life of King Saul, the first king of Israel, who will be coming to power. We'll be talking about that next week. And then looking at those latter years of Samuel's life, how he closes out his life, how he spends those latter years in his life. Really great things to learn from all the way around. Of course, we'll be introduced to King David as well. But each one of these persons serves as an example of how to, or in the case of Eli and his sons, how not to finish well. Throughout the series, what we've been looking at and learning from is their lives. And one of the things that we've seen consistently that has always captured my attention as I read through 1 Samuel is that it's not really so much about how you finish that guarantees that you finish well. But instead, finishing well is a long, intentional process of growth rather than an overnight cure. It's not something we become suddenly. It's not something we decide one day, I'm going to finish well. It's something that we make that decision, and 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 we make that decision for the rest of our lives, day by day. It's something that God does in us, that we do in partnership with God, but that it takes us being very intentional to arrive at finishing well. Now, as we look today at the reign of Samuel as judge of Israel, and one of the things that's interesting is how this will continue to contrast with Eli's unfaithfulness. As much as, you know, Eli's already dead and gone, and here's the thing that's intriguing in this, that Eli keeps coming to the forefront in contrast to the life of Samuel. It doesn't quit just when Eli and his sons are gone, but that subject matter comes up again and again and again. Eli's unfaithfulness and his tolerance of corruption, primarily because it was his own children, but still, nonetheless, his tolerance of corruption becomes a scourge on an entire nation. In contrast, Samuel's faithfulness to God and to and his godly leadership that he interjects into the community becomes the key to latter protection, to great prosperity in the nation. And we get reminded of this simple fact that the best defense might be to avoid offense of the Almighty. Just a thought there. Let's take a look. We're in 1 Samuel chapter 7, beginning in verse 1. I'll be reading, like I said, from the English Standard Version. You feel free to read along in whatever translation you have in your lap. If you're using a pad or a phone, please set that to stun to not bother those around you. I know they'll appreciate it. 1 Samuel 7, beginning in verse 1. And the men of Kiriath-Jearim came and took up the ark of the Lord and brought it to the house of Abinadab on the hill. And they consecrated his son Eleazar to have charge of the ark of the Lord. And from that day, the ark of the Lord was lodged at Kiriath-Jearim. A long time passed, some 20 years, and all the house of Israel lamented after the Lord. And Samuel said to all the house of Israel, if you are returning to the Lord with all your heart, then put away your foreign gods and your Ashtaroth from among you, and direct your heart to the Lord and serve him only, and he will deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines. So the people of Israel put away their Baals, their Ashtaroth, and they served the Lord only. Then Samuel said, gather all of Israel at Mizpah, and I will pray to the Lord for you. So that they gathered at Mizpah and drew water and poured it out before the Lord and fasted on that day and said there, we have sinned against the Lord. And Samuel judged the people of Israel at Mizpah. And now when the Philistines heard that the people of Israel had gathered at Mizpah, the lords of the Philistines went up against Israel. And when the people of Israel heard of it, they were afraid of the Philistines. And the people of Israel said to Samuel, do not cease to cry out to the Lord our God for us, that he may save us from the hand of the Philistines. So Samuel took a nursing lamb and offered it as a whole burnt offering to the Lord. And Samuel cried out to the Lord for Israel, and the Lord answered him. And Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, and the Philistines drew near to attack Israel. But the Lord thundered with a mighty sound that day against the Philistines and threw them into confusion. And they were defeated before Israel. And the men of Israel went out from Mizpah and pursued the Philistines and struck them as far as below Beth-Kar. Then Samuel took a stone and set it up between Mizpah and Shen and called its name Ebenezer. If you've ever heard the song, "Now I Raise My Ebenezer," it's a memorial stone. That's what an Ebenezer is. So now, don't you feel enlightened? Everybody wants to, yeah, okay, no, not really. All right. For he said, "Till now the Lord has helped us." So the Philistines were subdued and did not again enter the territory of Israel. And the hand of the Lord was against the Philistines all the days of Samuel. And the cities that the Philistines had taken from Israel were restored to Israel, from Ekron to Gath, and Israel delivered their territory from the hand of the Philistines, and there was peace also between Israel and the Amorites. Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life, and when he went on a circuit year by year to Bethel, to Gilgal, and Mizpah, and he judged Israel in all those places, and then he would return to Ramah, for his home was there, and there he also judged Israel, and he built there an altar to the Lord. Now, a couple of things I want to catch you up on real quick here. One, keep in mind this, that when we use the word judge, always in the Old Testament, it is not just in the sense of how you and I think about a judge in our modern context. Our context is heavily influenced by the Roman and the Greco-Roman view of law, and law is about punishment, and therefore the whole purpose of law is to scold people. Now, in the Hebrew view of law, the purpose of law is to instruct people. If you think of the first five books of the Bible, those are called the law. And when you read those, what's intriguing is that there's not a lot of court cases in there. You don't have a lot of people sitting there and saying, "Now you did bad and you did good." And you know, that's not what's going on. When you're reading those stories, you're learning from people's lives, and they are instructing you and I, how we live with God and about what a relationship with God looks like, and how does God connect with people? How does he relate to them? What's God's expectations? And so a judge, his first and primary role as judge is instructor. And so there's a huge difference. When you and I think of a judge, we think of a guy sitting in a black robe with a gavel and he says, "Punished. Death. Pay the fine. Go to jail. All the above." Right? I mean, that's our concept of a judge. But in Israel, we've got judges that are going to battle. We've got judges that are giving the nation direction. We've got judges. These judges are doing a whole lot more than what we think of as a judge. So it's very important when it says that he went to this town and to this town and this town to judge, it doesn't mean he held court necessarily. It means that he went and he instructed the people. He gave them direction. Sometimes it does mean that he sat there and listened to two sides and made a judgment. But the primary purpose of a judge is to teach, to instruct, to give direction. And that's why when you talk about the law in the Old Testament and you read those first five books, that yes, when you look in Leviticus, there are some laws, some rules, but vast majority of the material of the law is referring to instruction, historical instruction, emotional and philosophical instruction. Do you know that even there are some places in the Proverbs where it refers to the Psalms and the other Proverbs as the law? And yet whenever you read Psalms and Proverbs, you don't get a whole lot of judgment kind of things right there. You get instruction primarily, especially in the book of Proverbs. Tremendous amount of instruction, wisdom, literature, just meant to help us become more wise. And then the other thing I wanted to point out is, just because it's kind of a fun fact, Mizpah. How many of you, when years ago, moms, dads, you may not really want to admit this, I don't know if your teenager's sitting next to you, but you had a Mizpah necklace. You know, the little thing, it's the two halves, and it was, you know, cut through the middle, and it said, "The Lord, you know, watch over you and I when we are apart from one another." It was kind of a romantic thing. Yeah, teenagers were doing it. They would get like the necklace, and they would give one half to the boyfriend or girlfriend, and I just thought it was so romantic. And yet, you do know that Mizpah was a place of agreement after a fight between family members, and the idea was, God watch over you, buddy. And if you don't take good care of my daughter, I will come and I will hunt you down and kill you and take everybody back. Not so romantic. Yeah. Just in case that's getting popular again. I would see people wearing those and I would be like, do you know, gosh, it's not romantic. Don't do that. Okay. Anyhow, it's amazing how all those ended up in breakups. Anyhow, we did not. Oh, my gracious. I got to stop. Okay. So, as we jump into chapter 7, one other thing I need to clue you in on is the backdrop of this context. Now, not very interesting preaching, so I'm just going to kind of fill you the background in this, is that in the events, as we got finished up chapter 4, and we had the curse that was pronounced against Eli and his family was that his sons would die, that they would be judged, they would be killed, and that Eli would live to know about it, and then he would pass on. And that his family would no longer reign over Israel. They would no longer be the high priest. That even his one, the grandson that would be born to him would, and the following generations would always be in a subservient role. They would no longer lead Israel because of the continued unfaithfulness of the family. And so in chapters 5 and 6, what do we have? We have Hophni and Phinehas going into battle, and they get the Ark of the Lord. Now, the Ark of the Lord, if you didn't know what the Ark of the Lord is, it is a great big box. And they've got poles on the end. It's got all kinds of beautiful ornamental work on it to symbolize the mercy seat of God, where God sits and reigns over his people. It's the throne of God. And so the Ark was symbolic of God's presence. And a common practice throughout the Old Testament was when they were going to battle, they would put the ark on these poles and they would carry the ark, believing that God was going before them into battle and would wage the war for them. And that was why that they were able to defeat enemies much larger than them. And the people in the nations around them, that those little small city-states gathered around them, knew of their history when they left Egypt and how God waged war against Egypt for them and brought the plagues on Egypt. They knew how Israel had come into the land and God had dealt with the nations that were there as they were inheriting their promised land. And so whenever they would bring out the ark, the nations around them, the other city states around them would go, "Oh no, the God who wiped out the Egyptians, the superpower, that God is coming to wage war against our God." And they would say, "We were afraid." And many times they would run away and not even engage in battle. Other times they would just faint in battle. They would lose heart before they ever get started. Anybody know that when you get into a battle or you get into a competition, if you've already made up your mind that you're going to lose, you're going to... it's just a matter of, I mean, there's just no getting around that. If you give up before you get started, and many times that's what happened to Israel's enemies. And so this time, as they were marching into battle, the Philistines went, "Oh no." And they said to themselves, "The God that wiped out the gods of Israel, he has come into the camp and is going to wage war against us. What do we do?" But to see, the Philistines were a warrior-like people. They didn't do what the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Hivites and the other ites did. They said, "You know what? We've seen what happens when Israel dominates another nation. Unless you want their foot on your neck, you better fight for all you've got. Because their God is waging war against us, but we don't give up." They went into battle boldly. They went into battle to wage war against. And here's what happened. The God of Israel lifted his hand of protection against them. So that not only were Hophni and Phinehas, who were carrying the ark, killed, but they captured the ark and they defeated Israel. And when they did, they said, whose God is the biggest now, buddy? And so they took the Ark of the Covenant and they said, the God who beat up all the gods of Egypt. They're pumped now. They're about ready to go attack Egypt. They're just a ragtag bunch of little city-states, but man, beat the gods of the Egyptians, man. We are bad news. They get the box, they take the box in, they put it in front of their god Dagon, in front of his statue, and they say, see this? Dagon's standing up here, their god's down here. Bow before Dagon, Yahweh. And they close the door. And they came back in the next morning, and Dagon was on the ground, bowed before the Ark of the Covenant. It might be a clue, but these people are so thick-headed, they went to war against the God who defeated the Israelites. So they're pretty stubborn. They're like, no, they put their God right back up, and they closed the door, they left, they came back the next day, and Yahweh God snapped off his head, his arms, his feet, and put him in a pile in front of the Ark of the Covenant and threw his head and hands at the door. And they went, oh no, I think we made Yahweh mad. And then a plague of growths, tumor-like things, came on all the people. And rats infested their city. Something like what happened in Egypt. And they went, oh, Dagon's not that bad. And we're not that bad. Yahweh, he's bad, man. He's powerful. What do we do? How do we stop him? We don't have these people in our capture. And somebody says, well, you know what you do? You pack this all up and you put it on a cart and you set an offering of gold. And if Yahweh forgives you, it will go home without ever having to be steered there. And you'll know that it was the hand of Yahweh against you. And if he just walks around in circles, then it's something else. And so they did just what he said. And lo and behold, the cart with the ox and the gold all made its way to Israel. And the people of Israel took the animal and made an offering out of it to God. And right where it first crossed the line into Israel is where they decided to keep it. And here's what Israel's conclusion was. Well, God wasn't for us. So there's basically no need to take the Ark of the Covenant back to the tabernacle, because our priests were wiped out. Now, obviously, the Philistines are really powerful. Maybe we ought to worship those gods too. And they missed the whole point. See, they weren't in Dagon's temple. They don't know what happened. They just know they got their ark back. So they made a lot of erroneous conclusions. You know, a lot of times when things don't turn out the way that we think they should, or we give kind of lip service to God in some outward expression, like carrying the ark before us to show him off and to strut out our God stuff so that the neighbors can see. We used to say whenever I was in prison ministry, the bigger the cross, the bigger the liar. That's not fair. I know some people with some big, beautiful crosses, but the point was that in prison work, there was the thought of that people were just, well, you've maybe heard the saying, everybody gets religion in prison. But it's not really true. It's not even remotely true. Not that many people, you know, have that conversion experience. And the vast majority of them that have those experiences in prison do continue to walk faithfully with the Lord. But we have this persona. Sometimes people do put on a persona, not just in prison, but outside. Sometimes they're regular church attenders. Hello? And we put on a face for church, and we put on a face and play church, and yet the gap between who we are and what we're really like are just miles apart. It always captures my attention when someone says something like this to me. You know, I told somebody the other day that I go to church, and they were just amazed. They were surprised by that. When that happens, that's a reality check. That's not a on them. That's not a you need to say more. That's a you need to live more. That one's for free. Anyhow. So that's the backdrop. Eli's sons are dead. Dagon is on the floor. But now it's been 20 years. Let that figure just drop in your head for just a moment. I want you to think for just a moment ago, what were you doing 20 years ago? Some of you in the room are going, I didn't exist. Many of you are thinking to yourself, 20 years ago? Well, that wasn't that long ago. And then you start thinking about 20 years ago, and you begin to realize that 20 years ago was a long time ago. I was young. Some of you are saying, he's still young. I look in the mirror, I go, I was young. 20 years ago. Talk about not learning a lesson. See, here's the thing that doesn't make any sense. It says that they're lamenting the Lord and they're upset about what has happened to the Lord, but yet they have left the Ark of the Covenant in somebody's house and basically forgotten that Israel is their God. They are going after and pursuing all these other gods, and it's not until this point in which the Philistines have had their foot on their neck now for 20 years, and they finally go, hey, Samuel, do you think you could pray for us and we could do something about this situation? Now, they make it sound all spiritual, you know, like, oh, and all of Israel was lamenting for the Lord. Yeah, can I just remind you? All of the United States was lamenting after the Lord on 9/11. All of the United States was lamenting after the Lord on Patriots Day 2 years ago. There are times when a society collectively stops and takes notice of the fact that their God is seemingly not on their side, and they ask questions of why and what for, but it's a whole nother thing for to truly change the heart in the course of a nation. I kind of got scolded on 9/11 because while we held prayer services, I didn't do a whole bunch of pushing for people to in extra services and stuff like that. Because here's the thing, I was like, I don't see the qualitative heart change. I watched attendance soar in churches all over the United States, and 4 weeks later, I watched it drop below what it had been before. And I just felt really convicted by the Lord that it was all outward and not inward. Hello? So Israel's had a 9/11, a Patriot Day kind of experience. They've gotten stuff kicked in their face. They're being oppressed by their enemy. The foot of their neck is of their enemy is on their neck, and they're just like going, God, help. Samuel, do something. And Samuel says, well, if you'll really repent, then you'll also get rid of all your idols. You'll also turn your heart wholly toward the Lord. And then I will pray for you. So Israel does. Israel has this collective recognition day, and they bring their they cut down their Asherah poles, they tear down the altars to Baal, and they come before the Lord and they pour their heart out. They are sold out this day. And say they're sold out every day. I said they are sold out this day. And Samuel prays, and he offers sacrifice, and the hand of God returns to bring protection and blessing. And then it says, and for the rest of Samuel's days, that the blessing and the protection of the Lord was on Israel, and Samuel was judge. He led Israel for the rest of his days. And Israel prospered under his hand. You see, there was a fundamental shift in the change of how those people reacted to God, of what was going on. They didn't just simply have a church service that day. People collectively changed, and his leadership made a tremendous amount of difference. But can I point this out to you? That Israel and Samuel, while they had this moment, that moment didn't make things. See, Samuel didn't become a godly, upright individual that day. Samuel became a godly, upright individual from birth, and he walked it out, and he had a mama that was there, Hannah, teaching him and leading him and preparing him. And whenever he got to the place where his leadership was called upon, his character was already there, because I can guarantee you, looking at Eli and his sons, that power without character leads to corruption. On the other hand, power in the hands of those who are already good does really great things. God has all power. He does good things. People who are corrupt in their nature, just because they didn't have the power to do something before, now they have the power to do whatever it is that's in their heart. Power doesn't make people. Power only shows you what's already there. Money doesn't make people corrupt. Money will just show you what's already there. Why do you think when people win the lottery, but they weren't living in a way that was godly before, don't suddenly become godly now that they have a bunch of money? Hello? You know, most people that win the lottery, like, their lives get destroyed in short order. They end up in worse condition than they were before. Here's the thing. Can I just tell you, if you've made this promise to God, please stop making this promise to God. If I get rich someday, if I ever win the lottery, I'm going to start tithing. No, you won't. You know how many times I've known people who've won great sums of money and never did a thing for God with it? You know what I knew was how I knew that wasn't going to happen? Because they didn't do anything for God before. If you're waiting to get rich enough to do something for God, you won't. You'll never get that rich. However, some of the most generous people I know, both poor and rich, started where they were and continued to live that way. And regardless whether their income went down or their income went up, they continued to walk that way. Hello? It won't change you. It just shows who you are. Now, in the midst of all this craziness and everything, they're calling out to God. They want all this to happen. And the leadership of Eli is absolutely fundamental to the change of the whole nation. Leadership does matter. But the whole thing is this, that Samuel did and acted just as he would have done or acted whether he was judge of Israel, priest of Israel, or Joe Third Pew. See, the thing is every one of us, we are either a thermometer or we're the thermostat. We either set the temperature in the room and in the relationships that we're in, or we reflect it. You see, when you take a godly person and you put them in difficult circumstances, they begin to bring light into darkness. And when you take an ungodly person and you put them into, I don't know, say maybe church, and then they're not being instructed, not being discipled, and we give them a position of authority, and then they act just like they did before they came to church, and we're shocked. Can I tell you, putting someone in a role like, we want him to go to church more often, let's make him an elder, is like the most ridiculous thinking in the entire world. So one of the reasons that you may have noticed if you've been around the Vineyard for any amount of time is we don't give out titles. I really don't care if you ever call me pastor or not. If you call me pastor because I'm really your pastor, that's great. But here's the thing is, I really don't give a rip about a title. What I want to know is, are you doing what God has called you to do? You see, we call shepherds shepherds because they're shepherding. We call teachers teachers because they're already teaching. They shouldn't have to have a position called teacher before they start talking to people and instructing people. And people around them look and say, hey, that guy's kind of a, or that woman over there, she's a teacher. Elders, L, deacons, deek, long before they ever get a title. And if we have to wait for a title for somebody to do something, can I just tell you what they're not going to do? Because my history, and I've been in ministry now for over 25 years, okay, as a professional, you know, paid ministry person. And here's what I found out. There's nothing more dangerous than a deacon without a job or an elder who doesn't know how to eld. And on the flip side, I've watched people who have never been given the title of deacon and who, you know, the word deacon means serve, a servant. And I watch people who serve whether they have a title or not. And those are the people I want to recognize. And I watch people who shepherd the souls of others and care for them and disciple people and things like that. And that's the people I want to make an elder. But slapping on a title on someone doesn't make them do any of those things. Are you a thermometer or are you a thermostat? Do you just reflect what's happening around you? Or are you the one who sets the temperature in the room? Samuel lived his life real before the Lord. And the people knew it. And in their time of greatest need, they turned to him and asked him to pray for them. And then he did what any godly leader would do. He said, you know, well, what I need to be a great leader is I need a great big airplane and a fleet of cars and a great big salary. Oh, no, he didn't say that. He said, what I need to make a difference in Israel is I need for you to turn your hearts back to the Lord, because if I pray for you and I intercede to the Lord, you may have a moment of freedom. You may experience a moment of relief. But here's the thing. Israel can't change unless all of Israel changes. And he called them to repentance, and he called them to godliness, and he called them to put away all the other things that they worshiped and to worship God alone. And you know what? You and I live in an age in which the power of one is just amazing. One person can set the internet on fire. One person can hack a movie company and end their distribution of a movie. One church like Hillsong can change the face of worship all over the world. One man named Bin Laden can make the most powerful country in the world shake and change the way they do everyday life and even be afraid to open a cockpit on a plane. And even when he's gone, make us still give up tons of our freedoms and everything else in fear that there might be somebody else out there like him. The power of one. The power of one. So let me ask you this question then. One, what are you doing that's going to make a difference? Or will you just join the crowd? Will you just be the thermometer of the way things are? You see, you may say to yourself, I'm just one. One makes a tremendous difference. I am continually astounded at this. How one person can change the entire direction of a congregation, even. One complainer, or one person joyful and excited about the ministry. One pastor who decides that finishing well isn't worth it and runs off with a church secretary or a worship leader. Or one pastor who leads a church that literally is millions in attendance on Sunday morning. Yeah, there are churches that big. So my goal for you and I is that we finish well. That what we desire more than anything else is not so much to be in a place, a position of authority, or to be the greatest influence or anything else, but that we would live our lives in such a way so that God could trust us with great influence. So that the lives of the people around us are better because the influence of our presence, because our being a part of their lives makes them want to live better, because they see the example in us that we are not one way at church on Sunday and another at work on Monday. Because your presence in their life, they have a better chance of finishing well. I hope that's my influence in your life. I hope it's your influence in the lives of those around you. Let's stand together. Father, we come before you today just aware that more important than the numbers of people that we have influence over is what we do with the lives that you've given us. We thank you that Samuel, even as he was standing in the shadows, when he was just a boy in the temple, decided to live his life in such a way to give you glory and honor. We're grateful that even when Eli and the others passed away and nobody recognized him as the great leader of Israel, that he continued to walk in faithfulness and to be a man of God. So that when the nation quaked and feared, they knew where to turn to find a man of God. They weren't confused at that moment. They didn't have to question. They didn't have to appoint somebody in hopes that they would become good. They chose the obvious candidate before them. And I pray, Father, that among us, that we would live our lives in such a way that nobody has to guess. That we would live our lives in such a way that the lives of the people around us are better for it. That they feel called into your presence. That they see the example of godliness, of walking upright, of doing the right thing even when the chips are down, of keeping our word, of being people of integrity and honor. Lord, will you help us to finish well? There's some prayer team people in the back. if you have never made the decision to walk with Christ, I know that they would love to visit with you and talk to you about what it means to walk with Christ and to have a life that is centered around Jesus Christ, what it means to live well and to finish well. If you have any other needs this morning, maybe you need prayer for physical needs or for financial needs, maybe an emotional need, whatever. I know that our prayer team members in the back would love to take some time and pray with you. Let me invite you to take advantage of that opportunity. God bless you.